Welcome to Stories in the Key of Light. I'm Jen Mangloss.
And I'm Monica Roman Green. We're a podcast that talks about themes that speak to Christian spirituality in films across genres.
Today we're talking about the 1998 film Rushmore, directed by Wes Anderson and starring Jason Schwartzman and Bill Murray. We're not holding back from spoilers, so we encourage you to watch the film before you listen to the podcast. You can rent this movie on a variety of streaming sites. So let's move on to our initial observations. I'll start with myself because I'm so eager. And here's your warning. I am especially gushy when it comes to Wes Anderson films.
This is Jen's favorite.
I love Wes Anderson. I know he's not everyone's favorite director, but for those of you who enjoy his films, you get where I'm coming from. I just love his vision. And this is the first film of his that I ever saw. I watched it in a movie theater as a high schooler, and it left such a deep imprint on me as a film lover. I'd never seen a film like this before, and the world Wes created was curious and fascinating to me, and even though I consider other films of his to be better, Rushmore continues to be my favorite Wes Anderson film.
Yeah, this was my first Wes Anderson film that I saw as well, and by now, I counted. I've seen every one of his feature films. So
wow.
I've seen the whole thing. I personally think The Grand Budapest Hotel is his masterpiece.
Yeah.
But whenever anybody mentions Rushmore, I always think back on it quite fondly. Like, there's a charm about this film that is absolutely undeniable. For me, part of it is that I have been a Bill Murray fan forever.
He's amazing.
He is amazing. I mean, I'm way back Bill Murray. I was 13 when Ghostbusters came out, so you can imagine. And I had the crush on Bill Murray. I was actually one of those people that went to see The Razor's Edge in movie theaters. Anyone even remember that he did that serious film? Anyway, it was terrible, but I would follow Bill Murray anywhere at the time. So for me, this film was the beginning of the second half of his career. I remember when I watched this film, I was like, this is a revelation that Bill Murray is doing something different. Like, he's back and he's still himself, but there's a depth to him that I hadn't seen before. I know a lot of people say that that's Lost in Translation, which was a couple of years later. Mm. But to me, it was Rushmore. That's the first time I saw him do this. So I really appreciate the entire film. But as a Bill Murray fan, I think that's one of the reasons why Rushmore means so much to me.
Well, and your reaction to Bill Murray makes me think of my strong reaction to Max Fisher, played by Jason Schwartzman.
Oh, he's so cute.
I really honestly believe this. I think his character is going to go down as one of the most iconic characters in film.
I could see that.
Because he's just, I don't know, there's something about the way that character was crafted and portrayed. He's so believable as this naive and optimistic young man. And yet when he turns towards depression and obsession, somehow that also fits.
Mm-hmm.
And he feels like he lives in his own world, and he's kind of detached from the regular world. And there's moments when he can seem so mature for his age, you know, how he has his own stationery, the way he can talk with adults and feel comfortable
Absolutely.
With them. And then 2 seconds later, his immaturity comes blazing forth, and you remember that he's still a child.
Yeah.
Wes started working on the script for Rushmore before he wrote the script for Bottle Rocket, his first film.
Mm-hmm.
Rushmore is based on he and Owen Wilson's experiences in high school. Owen Wilson is a co-writer on this film.
Mm.
And so the connection to his own experience seems to give Max such depth.
Yeah, this was the first time any of us saw Jason Schwartzman act.
Ah.
Can you believe that? He just kills it in this film. He was 17 years old when they filmed Rushmore, and he had no prior acting experience at all. He completely carries this film, the whole time holding on to that tricky, quirky Anderson tone the entire way.
Well, and Wes has actors he likes to work with, such as Bill Murray. And this first pairing with Jason Schwartzman has led to multiple roles throughout the years.
Mm-hmm.
I have to admit, I'm always excited when I see that Jason's going to be in another role in a Wes film. And his voice work on The Fantastic Mr. Fox is so charming. I love it. Again, he's playing an awkward teenage role. And he does that so well. And now he's getting older, so that doesn't work as much for him. But there's something that just delights me when he's in a movie period, but especially when he's in a Wes Anderson film.
Yeah, he keeps popping up for me. Like, I'll see a movie or a television show or something that I'm interested in, and there's Jason Schwartzman. Like, clearly he and I have similar tastes.
Yes.
So that's good. Well, let's look at the spiritual themes. Some people might be surprised that we pull out spiritual themes out of a movie like Rushmore, but they're there.
We just like to be tricky with people.
Yeah.
We like to get your films you see as being obviously spiritual, and then we like the ones that aren't as much.
The ones that aren't as obvious, but there are some themes here, particularly particularly if you're looking at spirituality as having to do with relationship. And our understanding of spirituality has to do with relationship with God and others. So it definitely is in here. The character of Max Fisher, in some ways, when I was watching it, particularly this last time, is an extreme example of someone I tend to identify with. There's an early sequence in the film where they run through all of the extracurricular clubs that Max is either in or has started.
Yes, that scene is amazing.
Fantastic, right? It's so Wes Anderson. It's so quirky.
Iconic.
The timing of it is so brilliant, too, as it keeps going long after you think it should have ended. I just started to laugh and squirm at the same time because it hit me on a personal level. Because if you look at my high school yearbooks, particularly my senior year, my list of club memberships is almost as long as his. My picture's practically on every other page. It's a huge joke.
But were you also editor of the yearbook?
No, that I didn't do.
Okay.
That was one of the few things that I'm not on a page on. So I really identified with that, like all those extracurriculars, like what's that about, right? What is going on there? And even his propensity towards deception.
Yes.
He's so charming and can talk to anyone, but he has this propensity to tell people he's someone he's not. His dad is a neurosurgeon when he's actually a barber, and you know that he's doing well in school when he's actually failing. I mean, I never went that far, but I do remember personally stretching the truth at times to impress people, particularly when I was young. All that to say is I find that the character of Max Fisher is an excellent picture of someone who, like I tend to be, they cover up for their sense of worthlessness and shame through charm and overachievement and some deception. And the idea is to impress in order to feel accepted by others and, most importantly, by themselves. And I speak to this very openly from my own experience. I'm really glad that Max's schemes fall apart in this film because he needed to learn, just like I did, that he can be loved for exactly who he is. And that only came to me when I experienced personal failure in life. So often for personalities like his and mine, it's only failure that's going to bring us to a place where we find out that people still love us, even when we're at our worst or when we are exposed for who we are, not the person we painted ourselves to be. So people see underneath those shiny parts of us that we tend to show to the world. So this is a very important spiritual concept for our lives, because often that shame and that worthlessness comes that not only do we think others can't love us, but we think that God can't love us there as well. And so we're not always honest in our prayer life, this kind of personality, where we show up and be good for God and show our shininess to God when that's not who he's loving. Who he's loving is the more vulnerable, the one who's failing out of school, the one who is a barber's son. And so that's what I really appreciate about this film spiritually. But Jen, I know you've got great ideas. So tell me, what did you see in this film?
Well, it's interesting that you hooked on to identifying with his personality, because I too really resonate with Max Fisher's character. But to take it a step back, this is my struggle. It's hard for me to talk about just one Wes Anderson film. I always think of them collectively, but
yeah.
I think in general, Wes Anderson is well acquainted with loneliness.
Hmm.
Because more often than not, his characters are extremely lonely, and they seem to long for and be driven by a desire for connection.
Hmm.
And I think that's really why I connect with his characters, because I too can struggle with loneliness and not feeling known or seen and feeling a little outside of the norm. So his characters just resonate with me. I really track with them. And we see this loneliness with all of the characters in Rushmore. There's even a sequence where you see Mr. Bloom, you see Miss Cross and Max, and they're all, you can see how lonely and isolated they are.
Yeah.
There's one scene even where Max is eating a frozen dinner and something about that feels especially lonely. I don't know what it is about frozen meals, but it's like the quintessential example of loneliness.
Oh, man.
You know someone's in the dumps when they're eating a frozen meal.
Yeah.
But we see this loneliness, especially in Max. And even though, like you mentioned, he's really involved, he's surrounded by all these people, but you get the sense that he isn't really known or understood.
No, he's surrounded by followers,
yeah,
but not friends.
Yeah. So actually, his relationship with Herman is a little different.
Yes.
And once it gets to a healthy place, it's really good. But there's a sense that they get each other. But right. He doesn't have that much in his life. And I think actually part of his loneliness is attached to losing his mother at a young age, which he brings up, especially when he's with Miss Cross. But you hear that, you know, he lost his mom. He lost his mom to cancer.
Yeah.
And watching it this time, I noticed not only was she the one who got him into Rushmore, but there's an inscription from her on his typewriter. And it makes me wonder if she was the only one who really understood
his mom.
Yeah. His dad's lovely, but you get the sense that his dad doesn't quite know or get his son.
Yeah.
He's like, I guess you should go back to school, but he doesn't see what's happening to his son when he's having this breakdown.
Yes, that's true.
But the fact that his mother saw something in him, wanted him to go to this prep school, encouraged his writing and his creativity, you get the sense that she got him.
Yeah.
And so the loss of a person like that, I mean, the loss of a mother's hard, but when it's the loss of a mother who gets you, mm-hmm. that's felt really deeply. And so when you hold on to this truth, it makes more sense why he's so drawn to Miss Cross. Because she's also experienced loss, so they connect on that level. You know, she's this sort of maternal figure who seems to get him. I don't know how much she does understand him, but he has this way of his interactions with her kind of making them be what he needs them to be.
Right. He projects onto her because of the book, the Jacques Cousteau book, and what she wrote in it. In that moment, he thinks, oh, she understands me.
Yeah. So all these things are happening, and he's a teenager with raging hormones.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and that's where it gets complicated.
Yeah. So everything gets a little sexualized. And so what happens is this disordered attachment in his heart towards her. We would talk about this when we were in seminary. So often, our sinfulness actually comes out of these places of good desires. It's a good desire to be connected, to want to be in relationship with people. You know, it's a good desire to want to be mothered. God created us to desire relationship. We are created out of the Trinity, where relationship is constant and never ending between the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. And so we're oriented towards that type of connection. That's our true north.
Mm-hmm.
We also live in a very messy and broken world where we often are missed and we don't experience the connection we desire. So for Max, this loss of a mother and having a father who really does love him but doesn't understand him has led to these deep pockets of loneliness. And the desire for relationship was twisted and turned into this obsession with Miss Cross. So I just think it's such an astute picture of how we function as humans. As Christians, we can see that, wow, he's just hungry for people. Yes. He's hungry to be known.
Yeah.
That's what I love actually about life with God, is that it's not about ignoring those desires, but it's about tending to them. And that's actually where we see transformation come about in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
When those true desires get fed in the ways they were meant to.
Yes.
Not in the ways we try to recreate and fill in the gaps.
Yes. Which ties into the point that I was making, right? About needing to be loved as you are.
Yeah.
Because it is when Max, in his depression, he starts to own the fact that he is the son of a barber, right?
Yeah.
He kind of punishes himself with that for a while. But the beautiful moments of reconciliation are when he introduces his father to his friends.
Oh, absolutely. And what's interesting is by the end, after all this pain and distress, the relationships seem to settle back where they should be.
Mm-hmm.
You get this sense of, oh, all is right now, or at least moving in that direction.
Right.
And what's interesting is that closing scene is this sort of tableau. Everything slows down. There's that great song playing, ooh la la. This tableau kind of almost celebrates what's happened here.
Yeah.
Like almost like a painting. This is good. This is what should have happened. Everything before was necessary to get us here.
Yeah.
But this is a good place. Or at least everyone's on a better trajectory than where they were before.
Right.
Wes Anderson films don't always tie up so neat and tidily. And you still get the sense that there's like a unusual relationship between Max and Miss Cross. That's not fully resolved. But it's on a better path than where it was before.
Yeah.
But I just love how this film gets how people work. And talk about loneliness in ways that I don't often see addressed in film.
Yeah. You know, also what I think is most interesting about this film is the way that the breakdown happens between Herman and Max.
Yes.
And how that also speaks to what we're talking about, these unmet needs that we go and try and fulfill ourselves. Because this is the fight between a precocious 15-year-old boy and a grown man who has millions of dollars, built a million-dollar company. And you wouldn't think it would turn so petty, but this pure jealousy, this pure insecurity comes out of both of them, that they have to possess this woman and they have to fight each other to do it. So while it is kind of heightened and wacky, somehow you believe that both of these characters would walk down that path, that they would give in to that temptation to destroy the other in order to get what I need. So this is what happens when you live in a scarcity mentality. They both think this one person is going to save them. And they cannot share her. They can't, right? They've got to destroy each other. And God's kingdom is the opposite of that. God's kingdom is not about scarcity. It is about abundance, that God will provide in ways that you can't even imagine. But if you think that this is the only way you're going to get your need met, this is exactly the lie that Satan wants you to take. And it'll escalate into cutting the brakes on somebody's car.
Yeah. And part of their proclivity towards this jealousy and some of their personality, the parts of their personality that sets this up, is why they've connected in the first place.
That's true. That's
true. I mean, it's funny. It ends up being the cause of their breakup, but it's the sense of they're both so lonely.
Yeah. And broken. And broken in similar ways. That's why they're attracted to each other. But when they both are seeking the same way to meet that need, they have to decimate the other one. And it doesn't work. I was really moved this time when Max reaches out to Herman and sees he's in a bad way. And it's an incredible sequence. And so Bill Murray, when they're in the elevator together at the hospital, and he says, "Are you okay?" I mean, Bill Murray's clearly not okay. He's drunk and, I mean...
Oh, he looks awful.
He looks awful and he's, you know, hiding all of his cans and two cigarettes. So Bill Murray. But his answer is, "I'm a little lonely."
Yeah. Understatement of the year.
Understatement of the year, right? And I thought, oh, that was so moving. It's after that that Max invites him to his father's shop to get a haircut to be tended to.
Oh, and the moment when he shaved. There's just something so lovely about that. Even though this movie is quirky and funny, there's these moments that really are emotional for me. And that's one of them, because as much as his dad doesn't know what's going on, his dad just has this kind way of just tending to him. And sometimes our souls are tended to by simple things like having someone touch you, having someone, as a man, shave you. You know, as a woman, like if someone washes my hair, mm-hmm. when I get to my hair, yeah. then that's such a humanizing moment for
me. Even that shot that he takes straight down, you know, the classic mm-hmm. Wes Anderson, I'm looking straight down on something. The straight down is there's a towel and they wrap it around his face. And there's something just so lovely about that, like bundling him up and taking care of him. And, you know, even though Max's father doesn't understand him, he is a genuinely constant, loving presence.
He is.
And how often do we experience God like that? Like, you're not meeting me, my needs the way that I want you to, but you're there and you are consistent.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, look who is offering some of this love to the people. Like, he brings him into his world with his father. So I might be stretching the point a little bit, but there are very touching moments of connection in this film.
There really are. It gives the film even more depth. I mean, yeah, it's fun to see Bill and Jason go after each other and see how right. tricky they can get
right.
with trying to destroy the other person. And yet it's so nice that there is that turn that feels so human.
Yes. And there's another point in there, too, with Miss Cross about grief.
Yeah.
Is she stuck in her grief?
Oh, absolutely.
Right? It's Herman who says to Max, you know, it doesn't matter anyway, she's in love with a dead man. And it's Max who brings her out of her grief when he invites her to share about who he is in his room. And he would do more in his little fingernail. He had more talent in his little fingernail than anyone else. He just says his dead little fingernail.
Oh.
And it hits her. But it makes her see reality.
Yeah.
That she is pining for someone who's not there. And she has to move through her grief.
Yeah.
She has to continue to grieve. Grief is the process of letting go. And she's just hanging on.
Well, and that's why she has this unnatural attachment to Jason Schwartzman's character. Because mm-hmm. it's not completely one-sided.
No, no. She keeps coming back to him.
She does. What's interesting, it's subtle.
Uh-huh.
Even in that scene when he's pretended he's injured and he's yes. in the bedroom
mm-hmm.
and he goes to kiss her. And she kind of just pushes him back, but she's not forceful.
No.
You get the sense there's some indecision on her part.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was thinking of that scene, too. He's laying there, and she leans her chest across him. And I thought, why would you do that? Mm-hmm. As a woman, I would not choose to have myself in that close of physical proximity.
But it's all those little moments where you get the sense of what's going on her end. We don't get that fleshed out quite as much. But
no.
But Olivia Williams just does such a beautiful job of showing how many layers are there, even though we don't get all the backstory, we don't get the front row seat to her grief.
Yeah.
When she's there on the screen, she's showing it.
Yeah.
Just in her body language and the choices that she's making.
And there's clearly something in her brokenness that these two, this man and this boy, are drawn to. It does make sense. It's a quirky world. But that's what's so great about Wes Anderson's films, is this quirky world holds.
It does. Like,
there's an internal logic that makes perfect sense. And if you're willing to give yourself over to it, you're going to have an incredible ride.
Yeah.
So what about the film craft, Jen?
Ah, what do you like about the, I love everything about this movie. Here I am. I'm going to talk about Wes Anderson films a little more broadly.
Okay.
But there's so many components to his films. Interesting nostalgic music, twee and quirky visuals, symmetry, deadpan delivery.
Those colors.
Colors.
A little less in Rushmore than others. Like, he develops it more later. But he's very mindful. Specific props having very, being weighted with meaning. Like the pins that they share.
Mm-hmm. So sweet. Well, and then his characters, too, are these unique blends of naive and morose. It works so well, but you'd never think that would work. But there are moments when, with Max, he genuinely is this, there's this naivete and like simplicity to him. And yet when you see that depressive side, but it makes sense with the characters. But I see that again and again in Wes Anderson films.
Yeah.
Or even if it's not in one character, you'll see it in, you know, maybe one character who leans a little more on the naive side and one person who's a little more depressive. But they're always there and it works well together. But in Rushmore, Anderson created this world that just feels slightly off from real life.
Right.
You know, there's not spaceships. There's nothing that would tell us this isn't our real world. But everything's a little heightened. It almost feels like I'm in a storybook.
Yes.
And his movies feel like that.
Yes.
Or like in a diorama where things that aren't possible necessarily in real life are possible here.
I've always likened Wes Anderson to an animator. And he has done two animated films, which makes sense because he approaches his live action films in a similar way that an animator would, which is attention to every single detail is created in his own mind. That gives it that storybook feel, that heightened, you know, there's curtains opening and closing.
Yes.
It's very presentational in that way.
Yes.
And there's also chapters, right? There's actually chapter titles. So like a book, it's formatted in that way.
Well, and how often do you see a teenage boy who writes plays and works in a typewriter and arranges for the building of an aquarium? I mean, technically these are possible, but I can't think of a single human being I've known who's done all these things. It's this very down-to-earth fantasy.
Yes.
But what I really love about a Wes Anderson film, there's many things, but one of the things I really enjoy is the music. And it really stands out for me in this film. Maybe more than, I don't know, this is a big statement. The music in Rushmore might stand out to me more than the music in any of his other films.
I think he leans on it more heavily in Rushmore.
He might. And there's some really iconic sequences where the music's such an important part. The sequence with the yearbook, with Making Time, that song.
Right.
Those are just married together. And the song at the end, Ooh La La, while everything slows down and everyone starts dancing.
Yeah.
I mean, those are just such gorgeous scenes that the music adds so much to it. But for me, it's not just the songs they've chosen, but the score itself. So the score is by Mark Mothersbaugh.
Woo!
Yeah.
Love him.
Yeah, he's great. And so it gives this, it adds to the, all the visuals are telling you this, creating this world for you, and the music adds to that. There's this almost harpsichordical kind of, like, we're fancy people, and here's the curtains opening and closing. I love the way that the score adds to that.
Yes.
But it really is the songs they've chosen, and they really lean heavily on 60s and 70s music, which Wes does generally. But he worked with the same music supervisor, Randall Poster.
That makes sense why it's so consistent across his films.
Yeah. I'd love to be a fly on the wall in one of their conversations. The music adds to the nostalgia, because we haven't touched on this, but his films feel very nostalgic.
Yes, they do.
They tend not to have cell phones. So you don't always have a sense of when this is taking place, but it always feels like it harkens back to a time not now. And so with this music being nostalgic, it has this way of offering the least expected song, while the song choices also make complete sense. Like, if I think about it, why would a 60s song fit with this movie? But it always does. It always works.
Yeah.
Some song choices where you go, oh, I wouldn't have guessed that, but this is perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And the music choices were so significant for me that I can remember exact moments from the film just based on hearing one of the songs. I have a Spotify playlist that's Wes Anderson music.
Oh, wow.
I don't have songs from all the films, but quite a few songs from Rushmore. And I can just see it in my mind more so than any of his other movies. I adore how he uses music as this other layer of storytelling. And he does that so well.
Oh, yeah, I agreed. This film in particular of his feels wonderfully quirky and delightful without being overly so. Sometimes his films can lean a little far for some people. I'll go with the trip, but some people don't like it. But this one doesn't feel overly that. Like, he found this line and he held to it. And can I, for film craft, can I just shout out again to my man Bill Murray for being so believable and quietly funny as someone who would naturally befriend a precocious 15-year-old boy and to get into that spiteful, destructive battle of wills with him. And there's some just such choice little Bill Murray timing moments, like when he runs away from Miss Cross, he's hiding behind a tree and then he goes and sees her. And you have to pay attention because it's kind of off in the side of the frame, but he gets done talking to her and then he runs away like he's six or something. It's just so funny. Thank God for good actors.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny to hear the stories about how tough it is to get a hold of Bill Murray.
Yes.
There've been all these articles about how this elusive phone number.
Right.
There's
right.
A voicemail.
Uh-huh.
So to get Bill Murray in a movie feels like an accomplishment, but I read that he worked for
Scale.
He worked for Scale.
Yeah.
And there was a shot they wanted to do, and so this movie was released by Touchstone,
uh-huh.
which is a subsidiary of Disney, and they were balking at some of the shots they said were too expensive, and Bill Murray offered to fund them.
Wow,
which he's what a good dude. Man, yeah,
he's
but
a good
but
dude.
Yeah, I think this movie wouldn't be what it is without him and without Jason Schwartzman.
Absolutely. So okay, this we always end this with what didn't work because nothing's perfect. And this is really hard. I know. This is really hard. I think for me, Wes Anderson's style is so specific and presentational that some people who are used to a more naturalistic acting style and direction style can find it a little twee, right? That's an adjective that's often used to describe Wes Anderson films. But if you have a willing to give yourself over to an Anderson's world and logic, if you're going to do that, you generally have a wonderful ride. And so I didn't see a lot in this film that I would say is there's anything terribly wrong with it. And part of that is the way that Anderson really thinks everything through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no surprises here, me being a huge fan of his. It's hard for me to find what didn't work. But I did find the last third of the film a little, and I say a little draggy.
Slightly. Yeah.
Although at the same time, too, it could be argued that you really need to see him hit rock bottom.
That's what I said.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he really needs to try every single way he can to get with the teacher.
That's right.
Like, when you think he's finally given up and thrown in the towel, no.
No, there's one again. More time.
And there's something so beautifully pathetic about it. So it could have been tightened up a little bit. And actually, as I think about his subsequent films, I think he's gotten really good about that, mm-hmm. generally. You mm-hmm. know, those ends are... They're tight. I mean, he's never going to be this traditional storyteller where you have a MacGuffin and, there's not this big explosion at the end and reconciliation. I mean, that's not a Wes Anderson film. It's always going to take these odd little paths.
Although this film had lots of explosions at the end.
It did have explosions. That's true. But he takes these odd paths. So you're not going to get this like clear-cut storytelling. But the way he tells stories now, I think, has gotten a little cleaner since this one.
Yeah, it's still a very worthy film.
Oh, absolutely.
So those are our thoughts on Rushmore. We hope this stirred your imagination and love of film, like always. And we believe, like the psalmist said, that by God's light, we see light.
We'd love to hear your thoughts. Our Twitter handle is @KeyPodcast, or you can find us on Facebook @KeyPodcast. Simple enough. You can also find us on iTunes and other major podcasting apps. If you like what you hear, we'd appreciate it if you leave a review. And if you don't like it, please keep it to yourself.
We'd appreciate that. If you leave a review, that's a way that people can find us. So our in and out music is by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com. Thank you, Kevin. We hope you'll join us next time for more stories in the Key of Light.